Well, good evening and welcome to the New York Society Library. Many of you are familiar faces, some of you are not. It's really wonderful to have you all here tonight. I'm Mark Bartlett, the head librarian, and we're here for our second evening of our National Poetry Month celebration. Our library, for those of you who have not been here before, is the oldest in the city. We go back to 1754, and yes, we were buying books of poetry back then. Today I actually went into our closed stack and our rare books to look at some of our early periodicals and our early collections, and we have lots of very interesting things, and we continue to buy poetry to this day. If any of you do have a cell phone or an electronic device, a pager, an iPad, anything that's going to make a noise during the readings, please take it out now and silence it for the next hour. You are joining us tonight on what I hope will be an annual tradition, which is to celebrate poetry during this month of April with other agencies and institutions in the United States and here in New York City. Poetry's had a place in our library for a long time. We've had a good collecting policy with poetry, but we've also hosted a number of writers who have paid for memberships here over the years. It's a very long list, and I just wanted to give you a sample of a few of the names of people who, in no particular chronological order, have been members here at a certain point and are writers of poetry. Ogden Nash, Herman Melville, Edgar Lee Masters, Deborah Pease, Victoria Riddell, Mary Stuart Hammond, Adam Kirsch, Sally Bingham, Sally Dawidoff, Juna Barnes. The librettist, Lorenzo De Ponte, was a member here, and he actually deposited some of his Italian library here at the Society Library. The library today actually has an active writers program called The Writing Life, and a very popular element of The Writing Life is discussion groups and working groups for writers, and we have a very active poetry group led by Jan Grossman, one of our readers this evening. I was going to give you a long speech about my love of poetry and where it all started and all of that, but I'm just going to cut to the chase and tell you that when I grew up in my home, poetry was part of my family environment. I had a brother who started writing poetry when he was about three. He was 10 years older than me. And I just remember Brian sitting in his bunk bed, always being quiet and absorbed in a book. I remember him reading big tomes of Herman Melville and poets, and I always was kind of puzzled because he didn't want to come outside in the backyard and play with me. But my brother Brian was the person who, when I grew up a little bit and got in my teens, I realized that the life of the mind and the life of reading and the life of poetry was a fascinating thing to embrace. And very early on, I got to hear a great Canadian poet by the name of Alden Nowlan, who, if you don't know, he's a poet that was born in New Brunswick and is recognized as one of the greatest of the Canadian poets. If his name does not mean anything to you tonight, then please read the poem in the program and find a collection of his at a library and read some of his work. Over the years, I've had the great opportunity to hear wonderful poets living in different cities in North America, and since living here in New York, a couple that come to mind are Donald Hall, Marie Ponceau in this library, Mark Strand, and very happy that I was able to actually hear Stanley Kunitz on his last reading at his birthday celebration. I've asked each of our poets tonight to read for 15, 20 minutes. This is poetry, so, you know, depending on how quickly they read, it may wiggle to 20 minutes. We'll all give them the breathing space. But I've also asked them to read another poem by a writer that they cherish and love, or a poem that has inspired them in their work. So I'm not going to do the biographical speech about each of them. You have it in your program. I just want to say I'm really pleased to welcome these three wonderful writers to our podium. We will read in alphabetical order, so we'll start with Jan Grossman, and then Lewis Phillips, and finally David Yezzie will finish our evening. And do feel free when there are transitions, if you want to get up to have another soft drink or a glass of wine, Don't be shy. Restrooms are just outside the door to the left for women's. There's a men's just one floor above, and there's one down floor, so you can creep out and do that if you need to as well. So enjoy the evening.
Thank you, Mark. And I'd also like to thank Lynn Chase for making this evening event possible. It's really an honor to read at the library here, especially in April and in honor of National Poetry Month. Thank you. And it's such a pleasure to be reading with poets Lewis Phillips and David Yezzie. I'll be reading this evening from a manuscript in progress. It has a tentative title, Rethinking Eden, and I'll start with the title poem. And in the spirit of National Poetry Month, it's a poem in a traditional form. It's a sonnet. Rethinking Eden. I tell my love that we should celebrate our love and the fall. But he is not lulled by leaves, and he will not initiate a country drive or drink his cider mulled. So we rinse apples in the sink at home, marveling at all the varieties we know, the Cortland, the wine sap, the Rhone. I want to taste them all, these mysteries. So it may be that Eve, in the first flush of knowledge, wanted Adam just to taste and name the fruits, nothing more, but his blush inspired hers and got them both displaced. Yet we are here, side by side. He peels, I slice. And that is all we need of paradise. The painter's wife. The painter's wife is bathing. It is her sixth bath of the day. She sits in her round tub behind the bamboo screen for this one moment cleansed. Here, submerged in the colorless expanse of water which is never high enough, she breathes. But she must hold so still, make no waves, for he can appear silently, leaning lightly against the screen, the charcoal furtive against the white, as he studies her, the tub, the heap of her skirt, blouse, and boots on the wooden chair. Sometimes she does not even know he has been there, until she sees herself in color, bold, her arm curving over the edge, fingers clenched, her eyes closed. There is so much to purify, the touch of hands, the thoughts that beat and will not stop. She has washed away the woman in Paris, forgiven her now that she has died, wishing almost that they had met. She thinks she has seen her reflected in his eyes. The surface is glass, and she curls deeper below it, making herself as clear and small as she can, until she believes she is just a drop of water, too hard to see, even for the eyes that are everywhere, too fluid for the thinnest brush to follow. This next poem begins with a dream, and dreams, of course, are wonderful sources for poems. My problem in this case is that since I wrote the original version of this poem some time ago, I can no longer remember whether it was a real dream or not. But I'd like to take credit for dreaming it. Promenade all. I dream of a square dance. My partners are all doctors. In white coats and gingham bow ties, their stethoscopes swinging as we promenade to the left. Nurses sashay down the center, clapping and strewing robes as the caller shouts, "Open to the front! Open to the back!" I lie on a flat table, breathing. I am dressed for the occasion, blue paper gown loosely gathered with a white cellophane belt for that subtle look that says, "Examine me." Nothing invasive, I'm told, but what then of my right just to have a heart that murmurs with a valve that swings and closes lightly like the flutter wheel wings of a moth? The doctor and I circle left, circle right, as he glides me swiftly toward the door, grabs another lady from the waiting room and do-si-dos her down the hall. A bored dance partner, he has cast me off, a courtesy turn to someone new who will show me other steps. Among the lab coats, latex hands, I slide step from table to table until I am left clinging to the white paper, my footing lost. But when I reach the next plateau, black vinyl and crumpled pink sheet, the Echo Man waves his wand over my heart, and there is such a wind tunnel in me that I think the world can hear this rushing of waves, this strange, strong music I make, and the call to honor your partner in a dance where the partner now is life itself. So I am changed by the force of my own echoes and will not miss a beat. I am riding the sounds, dancing the waves, loving my heart. I often feel that I want to uncover more of the story behind something I may have read or an object I may have seen, and particularly in situations where there's a partial story and something seems to be missing. I'm going to read two poems which could, I think, be described as poems in search of more story. The first was inspired by a desk in this library. In fact, it's in this very room. I was sitting at the desk working on a poem and looking for a word when I suddenly realized I was surrounded by words. Among the readers. Anyone who writes at this desk leaves their mark. So a date, a name, little strokes become proof of small moments of passion, underlined, exclaimed, crossed out. The black surface lit by the window light and lamp from a distance is impermeable. Up close, tracings of the others, unexpected, unexplained, compete in etched layers. Here among the readers, I look down too, but I am not looking at my page. I am reading the thoughts of those who did not know they carved them, a witness to the fragile life of words. Even names overlap, so Scott H. is overcome by Diana. This fall gives way to never, and 10-20-06 wins out over love. It happens so quickly, a new pen pressing down across the wood, like a shift in affection that one does not see coming. It happens so quietly, like a stranger taking someone's place in the dark. And the words, then, the faint, tentative lines are covered by the wider, darkly drawn, and are lost, no matter what they said or how much it mattered. A few years ago, I was doing some historical research, and in the process of Googling and moving from site to site, I found an actual list of wedding gifts dating from the late 1800s. And I was fascinated by the objects on the list, so I quickly jotted it down and I went back to my research. And although I intended to retrace my steps and find the source again, I never could find it. But I was left with the list. The Wedding Trip, 1878. First, a long carriage ride, the groom and bride waving, tired of smiling since the altar, to the breakfast in the Lundy's round barn, whitewashed and dressed with flowers, to the farewells. It is good to sit and stare, remembering the rice. Too bad the bouquet went astray. Cousin Maddie had her hopes up, Katie too. Night falling and so many miles to go. So the bride unfurls the list she holds tight. Four rocking chairs, one hat rack, white bedspreads. He had no idea there would be so much. The house is small. How many butter knives can he use? How big is a cake basket? Silver pickle casters, too. Berry spoons, nickel tea kettle, china toilet set. She is almost singing now, a nice voice, but he sees the stretch of jelly jars and chairs, umbrellas in their stands like rows of crops. The sky is purple, dusky. Time to fold away the list, he tells her too firmly. Not enough light to read. Time now just to sit shoulder by shoulder and watch the road. He is thinking of the weight of vows, but in the dark she whispers, round bonbon dish. Her lips against his ear, 8 sugar spoons. Until he yields and joins her silly song, 1 clock, 6 ivory fish forks, pewter tray. Everything will change, but until they reach the falls, this is all there is, this one song. 4 rocking chairs, 1 hat rack, white bedspreads, both child's game and prayer rising in the night. On my way somewhere. It must have rained last night, for what I take from a distance to be a leaf of such perfect shape and size that I have to stop and admire it is not a leaf, but the gray stencil of one that left its wet and phantom print. Then, as if through a telescope's gathered light, it comes into close and altered range. I see its imperfections then, this shadow masquerading as leaf, without a trace of strident green or red or gold, no scent of rain-soaked silk or threading veins and solid stem. If the world is measured by what we expect, then this disappoints and looking again offends, as if there were nothing there at all. But what if I had no rigid scheme for what is real or why that matters, and on my way somewhere just came upon this pattern as I walked that seemed to rise at me, pointed, graceful, small, and knew it as leaf or nearly leaf and felt amazed. Shouldn't that have been enough? And I'll close with this next poem. The Old Book. This is one of the books the boy loved best. It is as funny as it always was, the pictures just as winning. It would still be worth running from room to find it if it were lost. Then sit with it in the early afternoon and read it once, waiting for him to flip back to the first page saying, again, again, oh, read it again. It is such a slim book. Now the same boy carries a backpack, always laden with notebooks, textbooks, tomes. Every day it gets heavier. He leaves before the sun now, comes home later, cheerful, burdened with books, arriving in the dark. So much reading and carrying. The woman, waiting for the water to boil, remembers every page. As she pours, the steam from the kettle makes it very hard to see. Someday, when he is not too busy, she might stand behind the chair of his desk saying, look, here is your old book. Just seeing the cover would make him laugh, but seeing it would be enough. Except that he, knowing her face so well, might stand, reaching for the book, asking, do you want to read it again? Start from the beginning. Thank you. As Mark said earlier, each of us has been asked tonight to read a poem that is particularly meaningful to us. So I'm going to read a poem by Wallace Stevens, and it's called The House Was Quiet and the World Was Calm. I think there are many reasons why I have strong feelings about this poem, but mostly I think it's because I had two grandfathers who loved books. And the poem really describes what I witnessed as I watched them reading. The house was quiet and the world was calm. The house was quiet and the world was calm. The reader became the book, and summer night was like the conscious being of the book. The house was quiet and the world was calm. The words were spoken as if there was no book, except that the reader leaned above the page, wanted to lean, wanted much, most to be the scholar to whom his book is true, to whom the summer night is like a perfection of thought. The house was quiet because it had to be. The quiet was part of the meaning, part of the mind, the access of perfection to the page. And the world was calm, the truth in a calm world in which there is no other meaning. Itself is calm. Itself is summer and night. Itself is the reader leaning late and reading there. Thank you.
I got a cold. My name is Lewis Phillips, but I didn't really recognize that name because for decades I've been sending poems out to magazines, and then they list the poets on the cover: Ezra Pound, David Yessie, and others. And for years I've been, and others. So I've been cashing checks under that name. I've done it so often, and others. That's one thing that makes me angry. The other thing that makes me angry, excuse me, is going into bookstores and they've got these books. 200 countries you're supposed to go to before you die. 700 novels you're supposed to read before you die. 200 women you should sleep with before you die. And it just really gets me so angry that people are telling me what I should do before I die. So I wrote a little poem. 7 words to hear before you die. You have already heard these 7 words. My Charles Bukowski poem. My poem can beat up your poem. When I was 25, some 5 or 6 years ago, oh, I hate an audience that can see right through you. I wrote a poem to celebrate my 25th birthday. And I wrote a poem which had 25 sections, one for each year, obviously. And that led the critics to say, although the poet thought his poem was nifty, thank God he didn't turn 50. One of the great things about living old is you outlive some of your enemies. So this is a section from a poem written a long time ago. I make these lines for the girl next door, well dead, crippled before 24. I do not know the married life she led, of kisses given in or out of bed. She had cancer, and it crept sideways most willingly throughout her womb, pinched her baby in its watery pouch. At 25, I have outlived some, and not know why or for whom. Death has come but one door down, that dutiful daughter who waits on all the tables of the world. And then, so I turned to 50, 5 or 6 years ago. How sharper than a serpent's tooth it is to have an audience that can see right through you. And I had this section. Again, it turned out to be 50 sections. I, too, have shed tears, but so far only a river. More to come, of course. What shall we do but make a lake of them, walk across them toward brightness, to a radiance of things felt? I'm going to read my poem that has my favorite title, What Do We Learn in Bed? What do we learn in bed but our bodies giving and our bodies taking? That is what I have learned sleeping and waking. What have I learned in bed, waking and sleeping? What your body gives is beyond taking. What your body takes is beyond keeping. That is what I have learned, waking and sleeping. This is called ironing and dancing, two things I don't do. Somehow, my sons took up ironing for some reason. They'd iron their clothes all the time. My 16-year-old son is ironing and dancing in the kitchen. How wonderful it must be to be young. I watch him across the greatest distance of all, from one generation to another, and think yin and yang, light and darkness, life and death, etc., etc., watching for that moment when he might reveal what he truly is, the human soul. At last I have located it, tearing the veil from all uncertainty. Your soul resides in every being you have ever loved. Now, when Mark asked us to choose a poet to read, someone who was different from me, I've decided to read a poem written by my son, who died last year. And because it's about poets, it's fitting. It's called From Auden to Larkin. Coming to Larkin by way of Auden, you drive a long road and turn right. In your rear view mirror is history, books with footnotes, religions, large moral decisions and armies they have gathered, and you should pick a side. But then you drive in, open the door. Nothing is arresting anymore but the ordinariness of having a life, of being yourself. You know, you couldn't be happier without being someone else. By Matthew Phillips. This is called Europe. I grew up in Hollywood, Florida, so none of my friends knew anything about Europe. What did I know about Europe? None of my teenage friends had been outside the United States. Their parents never went back. My family's idea of a vacation? Pack the car with two parents, one grandmother, three kids, drive to some attraction in Florida, stay in a motel or a tiny cottage, smelling of mothballs, rain, old socks, flies and mosquitoes butting heads against our window screens, or covering the outside yellow bulb until you couldn't see its light. The neon vacancy sign stayed on all night. For 25 cents, we could make our beds vibrate. My younger sisters would jump up and down, squeal, and act like jerks. No ghosts, we simply summoned as much laughter as we could. Sometimes there was a radio, and you had to put quarters into that, too. Never a television set. Thank God for The Shadow or Amos and Andy. Far out on the Atlantic, well-heeled travelers sipped champagne and got seasick, like Charlie Chaplin in some movie or another. What else they did? I had no idea. Before it got too dark, we would pile back into the car and drive around to find something to eat. Six of us would squeeze into a booth or sit around a formica table so we could worry over the menu how expensive everything was. Excuse me. Jim Harrison said, moving water is forever in the present tense. But people live in so many tenses at the same time. So I thought about that. The tense of water. Rot, rut, deep rut, rolled. I know I'm in a rut, because the ox cart wheels sink deep, shifting water from one planet to another, planets where there are no tenses, but stricken by falling water. I realize no matter what I do, history, that heavy ox cart bearing the dead and dying, rolls on, rolls on. Present tense, past tense, future tense, no tense, all those wheels turning, turning, galaxies spiraling, nebulae, and not one human being needs my forgiveness to survive. Yellow thistles and sunflowers bear up, and the body of things undone by time sizzle amid lightning, with burning elegance, then silence with all its openness. What are we trying so hard for? How does Haney's song go? You've been a good old wagon, but you done broke down. The oldest joke in poetry is, should I put more fire into my poetry? No, put more poetry into the fire. This is called timetables. Scanning arrivals and departures. I read timetables like small poems, haiku. Buses are late. Planes never on time. Love arrives decades too late. Schedules, flash fictions mimeoed in small offices by typists in white blouses with ink stains and coffee. Estimated dates of departure. Tickets abandoned on platforms. Where grief, with her streamer trunk and two large suitcases, sets down her dainty foot. not one red cap in sight. I have a little chapbook. I like just putting out my own little chapbooks and give them to people I like. There's a lot of people speak against self-publishing, but the only difference between me and Random House is $800 million or whatever. And if I had $800 million, people would come to me and say, why don't you publish me? So this is my little booklet. It's called Deadweight. As for the substance of love, it is not for us to weigh it, nor memorize distance between the living and the dead, measuring light years between breathing and non-breathing. As for the dead weight of love, it takes love to lift it. Now, I might have mentioned that 5 or 6 years ago, when I turned 25, I did this little poem to celebrate my birthday, and this is how that poem concluded. And one of my favorite poets is John Donne, and because he has a lucky name, he can make a lot of puns on it. Whereas with Phillips, you can't go many directions in terms of punning. So this was the end of that 25 years of living. Wife, attend me. Spider, unhinge. Lizard, pull in your languid tongue. Like John the poet, I am done. And I set my cap for both fair and brown. The sun beholds me with a different face. May I run in the wind until the wind falls down. So then, a few years later, when I did my 50th birthday poem, what should poets do but celebrate? And of course, another thing that makes me angry is the use and misuse of language. I was coming down the subway and it said, more than fresh pizza. Now to me, more than fresh means raw. And I'm really angry about people who use the word pre for everything. This is pre-used. This is pre-viewed. How can you have a pre-viewed tape? Either viewed it or you didn't view it. I'm pre-approved for everything. I'm never approved. I'm always pre-approved. But this was my final gesture at 50, having made it in spite of what the critics said. Blow out the candles and go to bed. Climb the stairs one more time. Stave off mortality as long as one can. Standing at my window, staring up the river toward a bridge of light, a massive talc of stars, toward a night gathering significant figures, a perplexity of size, I say what I said so many years before in true rhyme. I set my cap for both fair and brown. May I run in the wind until the wind falls down. Thank you.
I'll just take a minute and get settled, so if anyone does would like a glass of seltzer or wine, feel free.
Um,
Thanks to Mark and to Lynn Chase for having us here this evening. I'm delighted to be at the Society Library. I love the Society Library, and my children love it, and I use it all the time and really depend on it. So to be reading here is really a thrill and an honor, so I'm very, very, very happy to be here. I'm going to start, take Mark's suggestion and read a poem by another poet that I think will partly set the tone for a couple of poems that I'll read afterwards. And and I think for the whole reading, I'll probably, if I can, move from something like the ridiculous to something that's slightly more like the sublime. So I'll start with the ridiculous. And maybe a subtitle for this, for the first few poems, might be Writers Behaving Badly. And by which I mean mainly myself. You know, writers, like all people, are subject to baser emotions, envy, jealousy, schadenfreude, but if possible, maybe just slightly more so. This is a poem by Clive James, and I won't read the whole poem. It's a fairly long poem, but I'll read two stanzas of it, and I encourage you to look it up if you are taken by it. And the title of this poem is The Book of My Enemy Has Been Remaindered. The book of my enemy has been remaindered, and I rejoice. It has gone with bowed head like a defeated legion beneath the yoke. What avail him now his awards and prizes, the praise expended upon his meticulous technique, his individual new voice? Knocked into the middle of next week, his brainchild now consorts with the bad byes, the sinker, clinkers, dogs, and dregs, the Edsels of the world of movable type, the bummers that no amount of hype could shift, the unbudgeable turkeys. Soon now, a book of mine could be remaindered also, though not to the monumental extent in which the chastisement of remaindering has been meted out to the book of my enemy. Since in the case of my own book, it will be due to a miscalculated print run, a marketing error, nothing to do with merit. But just supposing that such an event should hold some slight element of sadness, it will be offset by the memory of this sweet moment. Chill the champagne and polish the crystal goblets. The book of my enemy has been remaindered, and I am glad. So maybe that's schadenfreude. I don't know. This is this might be envy. I have a poem out in the Atlantic Monthly this month, and I heard the editor, David Barber, once say publicly that he would love to publish light first, though he rarely had the chance. And so I sent him a bit of light first and kind of held his feet to the fire, so he printed it. And this is, I've never been to a writer's colony, and I'm extremely envious of the people who have been. So this is about that. It's called The Residency. I love my cabin and my writing table, my bright lunch pail, the mudded path. Then drinks begin, say, five-ish, Stoli or Red Label, and keep on till we've worked out all the kinks in our disheveled psyches. Back at home, it's hard how people don't know I'm an artist. I feel as useless as a garden gnome. They think I'm ordinary. That's the hardest.
Here, they understand the mess that's me, and everything about this place confirms what I've known deep down since the age of 3. I operate on slightly different terms than businessmen and lawyers and the crowd that trades and dickers, hires and fires, and when I tell the world my story, I tell it loud. I must get down to breakfast before 10. The cook, with every egg he scrambles, knows that he is giving me fresh fuel to fashion new Himalayas draped in dazzling snows of imagination backed by skies of passion. Thank you. It's a little mean spirit. It's not going to get better right away. I don't know if you're like me. In fact, I hope you're not like me in this regard. I sometimes get the feeling that when something good happens to someone that I know, that in some cosmic way it's prevented that from happening to me, that it's a kind of a zero-sum game, that because, you know, they have thrived in some way, I am diminished, so... This is called the good news. A friend calls, so I ask him to stop by. We sip old scotch, the good stuff, order in. Some Indian, no frills too fine for him or me, especially since it's been ages since we made the time. 2 drinks in, we've caught up on our plans. I've sleepwalked through the last few years by rote. He's had a nasty rough patch, quote unquote, on the home front. So we commiserate, cupping our low balls in our hands. It's great to see him. It's good to have a friend who feels the same as you about his lot, that while some grass is greener, your small plot is crudely arable. And though you're not so young, it's still not quite the end. As if remembering then, he spills his news. Though I was pretty lit, I swear it's true, it was as if a gold glow filled the room and shone on him. A sunshaft piercing through dense clouds behind which swept long views. In that rich light, he looked not like my friend, but some acquaintance brushed by on the train. Had his good fortune kept me from the same, I had to wonder, a zero-sum game that gave the night its early end? There was nothing strange. Our drinks were done, that's all. We haven't spoken since. By morning, I couldn't remember half of what the guy had said, just his good news, my slurred goodbye, the click of the latch, the quiet hall. So, I'm going to shift gears slightly for the second half here. And I'm going to read a sequence of 5 sonnets. A sonnet takes about a minute to read, so it won't be much longer than that. And it's from a recent issue of Poetry Magazine in which they had also an interview. And so it's online. You can read a little bit of the backstory of the poem, but I'll tell you, hopefully enough to kind of get the ball rolling, which is that I was visiting some friends in Boulder who are great rock climbers. And we'd been talking on the phone. And they're like, oh, well, maybe we should do some climbing when you're out here. I was like, okay, that sounds good. And I said, well, you know, what kind of climbing are we talking about? And he's like, oh, well, you know, I mean, can you do, like, I don't know, 45 degrees? And I was like, maybe. I mean, it's like, have you hiked before? It's like, yeah, I've hiked in Yosemite. He's like, you'll be fine. So I get out there. He takes me to the sporting goods store, and he suits me up with rock shoes. And he takes me out to the Flatirons, and we solo the Flatirons, which means that we climb them without gear. And I was so angry by the time I got to the top of this mountain. And then, of course, we had to climb down it. So, near-death experience has a very powerful way of focusing the mind. It's called Flatirons. And this poem, I think the others have been, fairly descriptive, fairly narrative. This is in a slightly more, I would say, kind of symbolist idiom, so just kind of rolls along. Flatirons. From the false summit, coxcomb, cum, arete, cool thermals underscore our frailties, past edges where our wingless feet are set, and the long look down dilutes the evergreens. As sandstone ends, the world of ghosts begins. They sometimes rise up still in dreams, my love. With one hand firm, I step onto the skin of the abyss, embracing what's above and severing spent ties to the scree below. The filtered light turns lichen eerie green, ushering in a world we hardly know, at least not one we're sure we've ever seen just so. Each climber brand new in his skin, no longer mired in waiting to begin. 2. The whisper clings beside you as you rise along the ice melt, following the chalk. Its cadence is the thrum behind your eyes, your trembling, the music of its talk. No longer trust your arms, they're paid with fear. Along the rock, the grip that's hidden there will not appear. Oh, sorry. Along the rock, the grip that's hidden there, invisible but sure, will not appear until you trade your fast hold for the air. And as you reach, it ripples like a pool in which your newfound safety now reflects. The diastole of breath becomes the rule for governing what atmosphere elects. To claim this height as owed to us in spirit, although we risk ourselves to answer it. 3. Free solo. Dearest, I am losing you. Not now, one hopes, but slowly, over time. Admit that there is nothing left to do but redevote our efforts to the climb, remembering that the second side is less than a reprieve, more sheer and far from kind, before the gentle, sloping wilderness enwraps us and we let go of the sky. Your living hand guides home my dangled foot. At gravity's unlikely slant, we smear across the arcos, knowing that the root has taken hold deep in the layers. Here, a thrust fault pushed up rock, and as it rose, it found its altitude in its repose. 4. Pinned to the face, you close the aperture. No way looks right, and there is no way down but keeping on. Returning's hot allure hissing its false promises, the sound of the last support beam loudly giving way. What is it that wipes the rock free of direction? The crystal ceiling that began the day goes black, almost, it seems, without detection. The open door blows shut, the empty glass brims over, and when raised, is dry again. Time's bait and switch. An hour from the pass, wind drags high clouds across the peak. Just then, the air grows cold. Our backs turn to the weather as a way comes clear, ascending with no tether. And finally, it's when we're most engaged with other things that the angel enters. A twist in temperature, a lightness in the chest that we call wings. Giddy with sacrament and the impure gluttony of blood and air and skin, we look with panoramic eyes to where the earth curls under and the sky begins. Though we ourselves are of this light-shot air, senses extending without obstacle, reaching past by rooting down through rock, obdurate kindness, heaven's windowsill. We are as useless as an open lock, more insubstantial than a drinking song, and marked by sandstone long after we're gone. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I want to thank all three of our readers. This was a really wonderful evening. We have more wine, soft drinks. There's a little bit of food left, and there's a nice house here. So please stay and have conversation. I do want to acknowledge Lynn Chase, who's in the front row. If you don't know Lynn, please come up and say hello to her. She's a wonderful person. She's the supporter of the book fund that she just set up this year for the library, which is going to support poetry collections, poetry books, books about poetry, poetics, in this library for a long time to come. And we are also going to be able to have events with her sponsorship. So we're so pleased that Mrs. Chase is with us tonight. She's been a trustee of our library. I'm going to forget what year you started, but you've been a trustee for a while, and she's now a trustee emeriti of the Society Library. And I'd like to have a round of applause for Mrs. Chase. So thank you once again to David, to Lewis, and to Jan for beautiful readings. Share poetry, take a book out, come and have a look to see what we have up here, and keep writing and keep reading. Thank you all, and get home safely.